I'm going to talk to you tonight about weighing things. That's when you put something on a set of scales and it reads a force, which is put into a mass. So most often you'll put some ingredients in a set of kitchen scales and you'll measure the mass or the weight. And we're going to look at various things, but before we start, this is Peter Hill Explains, where I talk about things scientific. Now I want to start to talk about a few usual things. You weigh a person. Think of weighing a tennis player who's bouncing their tennis ball, weighing a rabbit, a hopping rabbit. And then let's follow it further to weighing individual molecules, an individual atom, and eventually weighing some light. Now light, we know, has no mass, yet it might, if we really think about it, have a weight. It's an interesting thing to look at, and it gets you into thinking about light coming, escaping from black holes and things like that. Not escaping, but outside the event horizon, how light can climb out of a black hole. But let's get back to it. If you're weighing yourself, your mass, I'm going to give you a mass of 50 kilograms, because I think I've got a younger, slender audience, who got 50 kilograms, and that's in the Earth's gravitational field, and that means that you have an acceleration of 9.8 meters per second, and you would feel no upward force if you were in free fall. But what happens is that we stand on the surface of the Earth, and the Earth is really a big, big pile of repelling electrons. That's the bulkiness of any object is due to the Pauli exclusion principle. And it means that electrons can't slide through each other of the same quantum number, and therefore they pile up on each other. And we're sitting on a huge planet pile size pile of electrons. And so these electrons apply a force to us and stop us accelerating in the gravitational field. So when we feel a weight or feel a force, we feel the force of the Earth fighting our gravity. So if you sit on the scales and you're fortunate enough to have an acceleration of 9.8 meters per second and you weigh 50 kilograms, you'll have a weight force of 490 newtons downward force pushing against you, from the Earth pushing you up, and you will be pushing the Earth down by that amount. And so that force will be put into a force meter, and so at some point you'll deflect or compress something and you'll measure that compression, and that compression will be read out as a force and converted into your mass of 50 kilograms. If you take that to the moon, that set of scales to the moon, the gravitational field will be less, the force will be less. It will read your mass as less, but it will and read your force correctly, but your mass is unchanged. The force on you has reduced. Now, we're not going to wait here very long, so I'm going to ask you to imagine a set of scales. Which you apply a force down onto it, and underneath the scale there's a force of the Earth pushing up, and there's something which compresses, and you measure the compression of that, maybe a spring, maybe a piezoelectric crystal, something which measures its distortion, and you read that distortion off. So you can see a force by it accelerating something, or by how much it distorts something. So you can see that force. Now, we're not going to rest here very long. We're going to consider the fact that what happens if you start to jiggle up and down a little bit. What you'll notice is that your mass or the apparent force measured will vary. So if you jiggle up once a second, you'll see your force move up and down once a second. And would be good is that if you could average it, the actual signal times the amount of time, weighted by the amount of time you're at a particular mass, and see if you could actually change your apparent weight. And the answer is that as you jiggle up and down to push yourself up into the air, you push on the weight a bit, you push the scales down a bit more, and when you are in free fall, the scales weights is a little bit less, and this sinusoidal fluctuation will average out over time. So if you sit on the scales perfectly still for a minute, your mass will be read at 50 kilograms. If you jiggle up and down, that needle will vibrate evenly, or the number will go above and below evenly for your apparent mass, and over time, averaged, it will be the same mass. So let's move on a little bit more to consider a tennis player. Now, the tennis player has a tennis ball which weighs, say, 0.1 kilograms. That's probably about right, 0.1 kilograms. And they're just holding the ball, and the force required to hold that ball up goes all through your body, down through the scales, and is picked up. Next, 0.1 kilograms. And say you were very clever and you were able to zero the scales before and after you took the tennis ball, you'd actually be able to read that mass of the tennis ball directly. Now, if you release the tennis ball out of your hands, the force, its apparent mass will go to zero, and as it falls, it'll still be zero, and then there'll be a sudden thud, and that thud on the scales will be a force, and a force sufficient to bring it to rest. The ball compress, and when the ball deforms and reforms again, so what happens is the ball, and you can watch this in slow motion, the ball is decelerated, and the ball deforms, forms a spring, and when that spring uncoils, it goes back to circular, it launches the ball up again, all the time applying a force down, a little spike downwards, and that may be, say, a kilogram or even 2 kilograms force. You can definitely feel, if you feel a tennis ball thrown at you, you can feel that force. And what will happen if you time average it, say you bounce the ball 10 times a minute, catching it each time, if you measure the net force, the total force, or the apparent mass, the apparent mass will average to exactly the same mass as if you were just holding the ball. That's an important thing to think. Now, interesting thing is the ball is full of atoms, and the part of the springiness of the ball is the actual springiness of atoms. So we're going to remember that fact in a little while. So you have the ball. Now, imagine you've got the ball and you actually hit the ball harder onto the ground. So the mass seems to be higher. What happens is that when you grab it, the ball is still racing upwards, and it holds, and you hold it in your hand, and that upward force will travel through you and lift you up. And so as it bounces on the ground more energetically, it will hit your hand more energetically, and these forces will cancel out over time, and you've guessed it, your force meter will be able to calculate the mass of your tennis ball, even whether it's in free flight or bouncing hard or bouncing just softly so you can just catch it. All the factors will come together and give you the same mass over time. This is a very important point. Let's go off to a rabbit. This is a bit of a side step because I think people like to think of rabbits. Now, so you've got your 2 kilogram bunny. Our bunny's 2 kilograms, and it's on a set of scales, and it decides to have a little bit of a hop. And when it hops, and it hops into the air, it's in free fall, and there's actually no contact with the scales, so its mass goes to zero. But when it hits the ground again, its mass will go above 2 kilograms. The apparent or measured mass will go above 2 kilograms. So when it launches and when it re-hits the ground, its mass will increase apparent mass will increase. So the time average, your 2 kilogram bunny, if it just sits there, will be 2 kilograms all the time. If it jumps a little bit, it will go from 2 down to 4 kilograms, up to zero for a while, and then to 4, and go back to 2. Time average, that will still give you a 2 kilogram bunny rabbit. So our bunny rabbit, which we're keeping and much loved, has weighed exactly 2 kilograms all its adult life for many years. So let us now go and shrink that tennis ball down to the size of a molecule. Now, molecules are these amazing, or an atom, so to speak. Let's make it an argon atom to make it really simple to think about. So it doesn't spin, it's just a perfect little sphere. It is, in fact, an ideal super ball, super bouncy thing, because it's got its nucleus in the very centre, positive charge, and surrounded not as very tiny orbiting electrons, but as a big fuzzy amorphous blob. If you like, a gel is the electron. And so if you push that electron up and the nucleus is still travelling downwards, that will act as a perfect spring, and the atom will deform and reform perfectly and jump perfectly up. And so when you bounce an atom off a surface, it'll pick up and or lose a certain amount of thermal energy, but by and large it's a perfectly elastic collision. And if I have a oxygen molecule, so an argon atom, a single argon atom, and say, if you can imagine in a glass container, so you can imagine being able to see it, and you could actually fire emission light and actually locate it a little bit, it will go up and down. So quite exactly the same when it's in free fall, it'll have no mass. When it hits the base to bounce off, it will have a much greater mass, and as it decelerates going up, will have a slightly lower mass. So you can actually really ram it down, but because you've got the roof of it holding, again, that extra ram down is taken off again. So it averages out over time to give you the amount of mass of that atom. Now, let us imagine you've got a very sensitive scale, or you could, if you really wanted to, put thousands and billions, in fact an entire gas bottle of argon there, and you could actually weigh it. And if the argon bounces against the side walls, it bounces off elastically, so it's almost as if there's no side walls, it's only the bottom and the top wall which applies a force and gravitational field. And the argon is travelling faster downwards on average at the bottom, because it's actually fallen that height. And indeed, the pressure of an argon bottle varies just a little bit due to the gravitational force on that bottle. Similar to air pressure, we have about 50 to 100 kilometers of air holding us down, and the actual air pressure is the actual mass of the air above us. And so what's actually holding the air on our atmosphere is that gravitational field. So that's your atom bouncing up and down. So you have to imagine that there is this slight pressure difference. It doesn't hit the roof of the container as hard because compared to the bottom, so it can bounce harder at the bottom and harder at the roof due to the addition of more molecules pushing each other and the temperature pushing each other. But the differential pressure between the top and the bottom is just purely the gravitational field. It has to be that way for the conservation of energy. I think this is a very important thing to think about, because then we come across to the idea of measuring the mass of light, but the weight of a light beam. So, and this is one that you can really think about. So, I can hold light really forever by actually injecting it between two perfectly reflective mirrors and letting it go back and forth forever. And something which I really put my mind around, if you have the mirrors vertically, and so the light travels horizontally, that light will never ever hit the bottom scales, yet somehow, and I've got to think of it, it will be actually have a weight which can be measured. So that's something to think about. One of the things is that light doesn't actually travel perfectly straight on the surface of the Earth. It's actually slightly curved, so that may have some effect to really think through. I'm yet to do the full equations for it. But what I want to really talk about is a slightly simpler thing to imagine. Hopefully you've gone on my imaginary journey so far. I have my light and I have a mirror on the base of the scales and a mirror on the roof, and I inject the light and it bounces from the base of the scales up to the roof and back and down. It bounces up and down forever and more. And so when the light hits the mirror, it imparts a tiny little bit of momentum, which is H, Planck's constant, divided by its wavelength in meters. It's rather convenient. So if it's a microwave light, it's got almost no push on impact. But if it's infrared light, that's so near infrared, that's 1,000 nanometers. UV is 100 nanometers. It has more and more momentum, a very tiny momentum because Planck's constant is so small. But you are dividing it by the wavelength. So the wavelength's around 10 to the minus 9. The Planck's constant's around 6 by 10 to the minus 36, if I can remember it correctly. And so you've got many, many orders of magnitude, a very, very tiny momentum of the light. And the important thing here is that the you would think, oh, well, look, the light is always travelling at the speed of light, so therefore the momentum must be the same at the top or the bottom. So if it hits the bottom, it gives a slight tap downwards, and if it hits the top, it gives it a slight tap upwards. The top mirror is connected mechanically to the bottom mirror. Otherwise, they'd just float away, wouldn't they? They'd be pushed away, and you can have actually this light force. And you can see this in the universe, pushing the light force, pushing things around. And that light force is actually used in as actually physical force in supercooled atoms. You use the light force to push atoms which are beginning to travel towards you. They actually have a slightly a Doppler shift. Their wavelength changes, and you have the light tuned such that the molecules rushing towards the laser walk into the laser's absorption band, and the light interacts with the atom, emits, and the momentum change will slow that molecule down and move it back into its trap. So you have an iron light trap, or light-like cooling of a pool of atoms. But getting back to this, we have, imagine your light going up and down. Now, if light is a certain frequency, it's got a certain momentum, and it's got a certain speed, it doesn't change its speed under the gravitational field. But there is one thing that it will do. It will gravitationally redshift. Your blue light is at the bottom will gravitationally redshift as it comes up. And so there'll be a slight shift in your light hitting the top mirror. And it'll have a slightly less momentum because its wavelength will be ever that little bit bigger. And this momentum difference, the strength at which it hits the top mirror to the bottom mirror on your surf scales, will give a tiny, tiny weight to, and it's an actual weight, it's not an apparent weight, it is an actual weight, and that weight will vary, and you should be able to see it change on your gravitational field. And so if you've got a light of particular frequency, you can measure its weight and actually measure the effective gravitational field. And I suppose another thing to do is that it must have the same frequency going at the bottom or going at the top. And of course, that also means that the time is travelling, is moving a little bit different at the bottom of your scales to the top of your scales, just due to this experiment of measuring the weight of light. And that is sort of a very quick way of getting into general relativity. I've sort of discussed general relativity, slipped it in there. And I'll just close by taking a general note about how poorly special relativity is taught at school. So there's a lot of common sense light problems which I call special relativity zero, and that is just the effect of a clock travelling towards you. If you don't have the special relativity mark zero and you just only teach mark one, people will tell you that a clock, which is got the light coming from it, is blue shifted and it's travelling towards you, will be slowed down because its frame of reference is a moving frame, and anything in a moving frame time reduces. However, imagine that you have a minute's worth of footage of a clock moving, and that clock is travelling towards you. That minute is compressed, and so the actual clock appears to run faster as it's coming towards you. And this is special relativity, or just standard common sense special relativity mark zero. And then you can use your standard square root of 1 minus V squared on C squared, your standard Einstein's dilation coefficients, to adjust that. But indeed, light in a vehicle travelling towards you, the clocks appear to run more quickly. Then you can put an adjustment into of the Einstein coefficient, or the Einstein dilation factors, to adjust that, and then you can adjust it again to cover with acceleration, as we did in this thought experiment of light bouncing up between two mirrors in a gravitational field. So I just want to put a point for it. If I have a clock I have two clocks. I have one clock here on Earth, and I send another clock out to, at slow speed, it doesn't really matter what the speed is, out to Alpha Centauri. They've been synchronized now. At Alpha Centauri, the clock will be measure the same time, but for 4 years earlier. So this is 2018. It'll take thousands of years to get out to Alpha Centauri. But by the time it gets out to Alpha Centauri, the clock, which should be reading 2018, will be measuring 2014. Now, what happens is I say, this is no good. I want to send it on a spaceship coming towards me. Now, what will happen is that as I come towards me, the actual footage or film that I see, I send forward, will be blue shifted, the film will be compressed, and it will, as it goes into the past, it will run more, as it goes further away, it will run more slowly as it comes towards me. And you can do the maths of it, and it's a very simple thing to do. It will appear to run faster as it comes towards me until it's resynchronized. So if I put it to Alpha Centauri, it will go 4 years behind. if I bring it back towards me, it will go for, it will regain those 4 years. I can't get it to go in advance of it. And that's not special relativity, that's just the Doppler effect and the compression of light and time. Now, the speed with which it slows and the speed with which I do that has another effect, which is the special relativity effect. And there's another effect of the acceleration. So what is interesting is that the major effect is that zeroth effect of it just physically moving into our past and moving back from the past. So if you look at anything, I'm looking at the sky above. I'm staring at Sirius, the brightest star above me. It's beautiful. Night to night, you're looking into the past. And if you send something into the past, you actually do send it into the past, and its clocks run slower as it goes out there and speeds up as it brings back into our present. There is another effect due to, which is the special relativity effect, which is due to the moving frame effect. And even this moving frame effect gets undone by general relativity at the end. So you actually don't have the twin paradox. So if I accelerate at great speed with respect to me out to a distant star, the clocks will run slow, and I bring it back towards me to resynchronize it, the clocks will run slowly on the I will read the clocks running running slowly going out and in, but that will be corrected because in order to leave my frame, it has to accelerate. In order to turn around, it has to accelerate a second time. Then it has to accelerate again when it's coming back to rest at my frame. And so those little acceleration windows are what's added to get your clock exactly in time. So you can't actually cheat time at all. So it's a very interesting aspect. I'll just close by saying one thought, which I'll try and get. So it's a really easy thing to understand. What's the hardest aspect to understand, I suppose, is the fact that people forget to teach you some real basics at the start. The stuff you learn before special relativity, people gloss over it because they go straight to the special relativity textbook and just teach it away, and you wind up that you can't really explain these paradoxes in short because no one's asking questions about it or trying to explain it explain it very, very deeply. So that's an interesting thing. What I want to say finally is understanding about light and time itself. The thing is that you have to something has to have mass, and once it has mass, any sort of mass, it experiences time. And so light itself defines time, but it is one thing which does not experience time. So if you're in the frame of reference of the light traveling from the very beginning of the universe to now, if you're in that frame, it is as though no time has passed whatsoever. That's the entire thing do with mass, and it is very easy to think, well, if it's got mass, it's got no weight. But indeed, light does have a weight in a magnetic field, and actually can bend and curve. Sorry, not magnetic field, a gravitational field, can bend and curve. So I've tried to explain that. There's lots of things I can talk to you about light, but I've tried to explain that starting off with the idea of a set of scales. And bouncing the scales, and the fact that the weight of light that you measure in your photon scales, that's two mirrors, will actually measure gravitational field effect. And now, just before closing, this is too small to imagine. It is an actual fact, something which the GPS systems have to account for. All the time, and they use all these effects, all the zeroth special relativity, the standard special relativity, to account for clocks, and also general relativity, that those clocks are travelling a little bit faster compared to clocks on Earth because the gravitational field is that little bit higher. I suppose one of the things is that the GPS satellites are sufficiently far away. The satellites which just skim the surface of the atmosphere have almost the same gravitational field. It's just really only 100 kilometres up, gliding above it, so there's almost the same gravitational field. It does have a special relativity effect because of the relative velocity to us, but again, that is a complicated thing to calculate. So I just hope that a discussion of this has not been too confusing, you've thought about, I suppose, related in your head the journey of measuring your own mass, measuring the mass of something which is jumping up and down, to measuring the mass, or not the mass, but the weight of a light particle. And it requires a lot of thinking and really a lot of study beyond what you're taught and restricted at school. So that's all for tonight. And in the meantime, keep on doing science.